All right, let's do it.
Let's get it.
Hello, I'm Jason Fox.
And I'm John Anthony.
And you're listening to Kindred Spirits, where we dance amidst the liminal, weaving inversions that lead to conversions.
Watch your conversion. Hey, watch your margin.
I was like trying to do something about inversions. Oh God, because it's going to be. But thank you.
They sometimes do. You know, it's funny.
Go for it. Yep.
We're talking about margins. I think I sent you a photo, but my beautiful daughter had her first lemonade stand on the weekend. Fizzy, did I send you a picture? I don't know if I did.
No, you told me about it.
It was just so cute because we did it with our neighbors and they made Christmas cards and little bracelets and bashed out lemonade. But the cutest thing about it is that they're there obviously to spin a profit, but they don't really understand that to set the whole thing up, that costs money in the first place. You know, so in their head, it's all free money, right? And then you kind of feel like a boring dad trying to explain to them about like margins. Like you do understand that your mother had to purchase the lemons. You're breaking commerce down for a 6-year-old. Kind of takes the spirit out of the thing, doesn't it? Removes the joy.
Yeah. But this is actually this. I love that. I love to see photos. I reckon. Yeah, it's one of the most beautiful things. So I was about to say. I reckon our listeners would love to see a photo, but I didn't want to point that in because you might want photos of Phoenix out in the world. But
yeah, but maybe the stand. I mean, I can show.
Okay,
the stand.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Yeah. But this whole thing about margins, right? I've been reflecting on this podcast and. And the reason I brought up inversions is because I thought it might be quite fun for us to invert our usual biases and maybe shine a light on the other side of things. Because typically you and I show up in conversation and we're all pro-emergence.
Mm.
And we are eschewing or besmirching of structure, efficiency, expedience, extraction, rigidity, scripts. And at the same time, though, if someone is running a business, there are times when you actually want to have efficiency. You want to have a known process. You want to have predictability and so on. And I just thought, this could be fun. Perhaps as a rough guiding light for us, instead of responding to what you and I do is respond to an overemphasis in structure and order and efficiency in the machine. What if we were to kind of flip it and, dance on the other side, invert our own paradigms?
I love it, but that would involve us pre-setting the agenda of this before we do it. Have I heard you correct, Fizz?
No agenda. I'm just using this as this vague. I already feel that. I already feel the tension of like the structure, you know, stifling the group. It's more like this. Maybe it's me and my insecurity. I feel like we've been getting some lovely feedback from folks listening to this. Beautiful feedback.
It means the world to us.
It's so lovely. Folks listening saying that, like, we've had multiple folks say they listen multiple times to these episodes. I think I've got this vague paranoia that because I consistently show up in support of emergence and sacred entropy and sacred ambiguity and all of these things, that as a result, anyone listening will be thinking, oh shit, this guy's just going to come in and create chaos and stuff like that. But I know, I'm pretty sure for you and I, like if you went and you saw a team and you had all this scattering, duplicated effort, no one talking to each other, no one knowing what they're doing, I think that you would sense that, this kind of needs some, you know, just as you would with like music and stuff like that, we need like some rhythm here. We need to have some sort of structure. And so I'm just trying to do this for myself, try to kind of think, how would we show up and like slightly to argue the other side of the coin, if that makes sense?
Well, it does, because as you spoke about bringing the chaos, something that occurred to me that I do all the time instinctively is I feel like I step into systems and even into workshops or days with agendas that are already quite rigid even before they begin. And yeah. So part of where it is that I'm trying to add value is I'm introducing chaos into what is already an overly rigid agenda. And I know you and I have sort of spun that in our own way. But it's weird, as you were getting into that earlier and you spoke about predictability, you know, it reminded me of that idea that most of us understand instinctively that predictability is one of the many things that equal psychological safety. People want to know what's coming next, don't they? That's why they're always telling you to give kids a routine.
What's the agenda? Yeah.
You know, and I find it so cute because as a dad, it never occurred to me that if you don't give the kids the agenda, they start asking for it. So I've lost count now of how many times Phoenix has said to me, "Hey, Dad, what are we going to do today?" You know, and then what's going to happen? And then what's going to happen? And we never really shake that loose, do we? Everyone likes to have an idea about what's coming next, and so they should, you know. And the other fun argument is that the best predictor of the future is the past. And then if we want to go neuro for a second, we know that our brain is a future predicting machine just trying to keep you safe, built around previous experiences. That's the way that you're wired. You know, so it was funny because as you were saying all that stuff then, it occurred to me that I love getting rid of this myth, and it's mostly dead, that there are adult learning styles. Did you ever see this stale bullshit? Like, fizz?
I'm like a visual learner. I'm an auditory learner. I'm a kinesthetic.
I'm auditory, right? And you know, there are so many ways to destroy it. One of my favorites was a quote, or it might have been a podcast interview that I saw a couple of years ago with Adam Grant. And he spun it in a way that just made so much sense. He said, adult learning styles are a nonsense. It might be a nice idea to have a peripheral awareness of the different ways that people can learn. But if you want to be a lifelong learner or you hope to learn anything, then you must be able to take a chameleon approach. You must be able to pivot within your own learning style depending on content and context. And so the best example, Fizz, is you might say to me, J.A., can you teach me to drive? But before you do, just so you know, J.A., I'm a theorist. And so I go, okay, Jason, then read this book on how to drive, right? And then I chuck you a set of keys and say, get on with it, Pappy, right? This is the glitch, isn't it? You know, I mean, this is sort of the glitch. And it would almost be a weird question. Why do people tune into this? Because they don't know what's about to happen because you don't, neither do I. But what is it? Like, it's some kind of cooked labyrinth roller coaster. What is this?
Well, it's a dance, right? We meet each other in the present. We have a contemporaneity or some sort of fancy word to describe the meeting of each other with an openness to dance into emergence. You mentioned something before here that the learning styles, it makes me feel like, oh, this is this fucking quest for optimization, right? I'm a this person because of this diagnostic, so then I'll have my learning input tailored to in this way. And that might kind of result in a temporary expedience, but it results in a fragility because, yeah, cool. What happens if there are no theory books on how to drive, you know? Like, you've got to dance. I'm with you. The chameleon, like, shapeshift all the way. Only that which can change can continue. This is the principal way which infinite players live. I'm already like, I can't. Like, you mentioned the routine or the agenda, right? I have such perverse delight. Oh, such perverse delight in the person that's itching for the agenda. And I'll write down timing blocks so that people have a sense of when, like, a bathroom break is coming up.
Yeah, that's nice. Bio breaks. My friend Nick Nax calls it bio break. When do I get my caffeine? When do I get to vape? Exactly.
And then I'll describe, like, you know, any run sheet or agenda is like an amusing hypothesis for how the day will unfurl. Let's just kind of stay present and in the moment, because if we're somewhere that we need to be and the conversation is just ripe and we're confronting these like hidden commitments that have been holding us back, we're not going to sacrifice that just because, you know, it's coffee o'clock. We're just going to stay there for another 10 minutes. Yeah.
Sorry, but quiches are getting cold, so I'm going to stop you right there.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, cool. Thanks for humouring me. I gave it a good shot. I think. All right. So there's a deeper thing going on here. I've been feeling bad because, like, I feel like I take these earnest kind of, you know, these folks that have their efficiency things, and then I tease it here, and I don't want people to feel bad for me teasing a quest to optimize, but at the same time, I don't know. I tried anyway.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Anyway. But to loop around on what you were saying, we really do appreciate the feedback and the support. And, you know, one thing that has delighted me as we arrive at episode 10, my dear friend.
Huzzah. Yeah, double digits.
Is just how broad and unpredictable the audience is. Like, you know, professors in the States, commercial cleaners, security guards, builders, corporates, L&D folk. That's one
retired
thing.
Retired CEOs, it's a gamut. I actually had a conversation with a listener last night based in originally London, has just moved to the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And they were describing with deep appreciation what we do in kind of language that was just really, really lovely to hear. I wish I could have captured some of it down to share with you. But you're right. Like we have such I remember when we started, we were going to, you know, we're trying to talk to like fellow facilitator speaker, things like that. And that pops up as themes. Mm. But yeah, I think generally speaking, people just like us when we just just run with it.
And no one is their job. And I think you and I started in safe territory, which was we spoke about our jobs, but no one's their job. And I think, you know, that's why we're amassing such beautiful, broad kindred spirits is because we try to talk about the essence of things. Now, if anyone's curious, the reason why we're banging on about this is because Jason and I are fragile little fellows who require the feedback. Okay. So if you're a listener and you like it, you have to tell us. It honestly pumps up our tires like you wouldn't believe. And we're eternally grateful to understand whatever ripple is spreading from this thing.
It's so nice. And then there's also, so, you know, John Anthony and I caught up in person for a whiskey event at the Abbotsford Convent Whiskey Abbey. We sunk some exquisite whiskeys and had such a lovely day together. Yes, I got mine as well. Yeah,
I was hoping you brought your glass.
Nice. And, one of the things that we were talking about when we got together, because sometimes these ideas blossom up, usually I'm like, oh, yeah, we can do this. But this sensibility of, like, not trying too hard to make this a thing. There's this kind of, you know, capital T thing, right? There's
capital this ting-ting.
Yeah, so there's this kind of delicate, you know, there's a saying that Bayo Kamalafe is a wonderful philosopher and writer. He has this term, relating to animate or animacy sensibilities of looking away at. So you're looking at it, but you're looking away at it. It's kind of like you've got to look at it from the side of your eye, because if you look too directly, turn it into a goal, turn it into a thing, optimize it and stuff like that, you'll just render out the goal.
Medusa. Yes. You know, and it's funny because this reminds me of a great conversation we had when you spoke to me about a technique in bird watching where you don't want to stare into the eye of the sparrow. I'm now completely misquoting you. As Jason said, ye not stare in the eye of the sparrow, lest it fly. But, you know, that's what came to mind. Medusa, you know, you stare at it or you try to articulate it or you, you know, fossilize it into a thing, and then you turn into stone. You turn into stone. You know, it's anti-nebulous.
It's anti-nebulous, exactly. It's concretizing. Yeah, yeah. It's so sense. After you say that, like, so the kind of Medusa, which is like a gorgon, which is related to basilisk. Basilisk also has the petrifying gaze. There's a piece that was written by Paul Kingsnorth called The Basilisk, which is a conversation between a uncle and their niece effectively about the internet and kind of the machine and things like that. But this phrase, the eyes of the basilisk, that kind of everything it sees is rendered into stone. All life is rendered into an object with clear boundaries. And you can imagine how, you know, that outlook is what many leaders and managers and just people in this late stage economy, you know, capitalism, are groomed to kind of view things through the lens of utility, of like, what's in it for me? How do I extract this? How do I optimize this? And so on. And and I think partly our EverQuest, you and I, is to muddle that gaze, reopen the eye of value, to see things as complex, entwined, nebulous, interconnected, intercontingent, always already emerging and in flow and in their own poesis.
And it's funny because part of that for me instinctively is the deconstruction. Like, you need to break what you said it was before. You know, you need to shatter that paradigm of what it was that you wanted it to be, or what it was that you insist that it should be. You know, Albert Ellis, that legend who came up with rational emotive behavioral therapy, you know, I love this guy because he's got this beautiful philosophy, and you and I might have danced across this in the past, but he sort of talks about one of the best skeleton keys to a more harmonious existence is letting go of all this self-talk that you have around the way that you think that things must or ought to or better be. You got to get rid of it. You know, you graduate so much quicker into a place of acceptance when you let go of how it should or must or ought to or better be. And that's difficult, isn't it? That's difficult. But you know what we're dancing around here is that in our own way, we're scared to either try to say what this is or make it a thing, because then the second you do that, you kind of ruin it. It's like when people are in a new relationship and they say, I don't want to put labels on it. Like, it's the same kind of spirit, isn't it? Don't ruin it by saying what it is. Fascinating.
Yeah, and there's parallels here with the magic of naming, and also how that can go wrong when you can kind of collapse something into a name. I'm going to discard that tangent and just ask you, what's on your mind? What's been on your mind, or what's on your mind?
Thank you, my good friend. Something that I'm only just starting to play around with now, and it might be a bit too early for me to go into it. No, it's actually perfect because you would be ahead of me on the path here. This idea from Plotkin about soulcraft and more specifically getting into the idea that soul and spirit aren't the same thing. Like, I look forward to seeing what you have to say about that. Soul and spirit definitely aren't the same thing. But where I'm really fascinated now, and what I'm hoping we can blow open, is this idea that if you want to plummet into the depths of understanding your own soul, you know, maybe even separate to something like ego, like if you want to get into really understanding your soul and your reason for existence, then starting this journey or plummeting into this sort of level of self-awareness that may require things like shadow work and all the rest of it, my man, it's not the same thing as psychology. It's not the same thing as being in therapy. And what I love about beginning to understand this is that when you go to therapy, and mate, I'm a fan of it. You know, my mother's a clinical psychologist. I'm certainly not talking smack about it. But when you go to therapy, there's always these goals, aren't there? And when you're in therapy, the goals are about, how do I live better? How do I be happier? How do I regulate my emotions? How do I function smoother? How do I graduate to a place of harmony and cohesion? But really what you're trying to do is you're trying to find a way to adapt or survive within the existing shitful system that you have no choice but to be trapped in, right? So you're learning a bunch of coping strategies, really. You're learning how to cope with our own fucked up circumstances. That's why you're in therapy. Whereas if you're doing soul work, there's something very different about that. You know, it doesn't have the same inverted commas goals. You know, it's less kind of dirty in that way. And that if you really want to do this, there's a very real chance that you're not going to have a lot of fun. You're almost guaranteed a bit of a breakdown.
Oh, yeah.
You're guaranteed a breakdown before the breakthrough. So that is what has been on my mind.
Great thing to have on your mind. That's cool. I didn't know that was on your mind. This is it's almost a daily conversation with Kim and I. It's very well. This is even another layer of specialness to our friendship because it feels that there are a few people that I can speak to about this thing, and it's largely because the wider world is mostly locked within a cage of our own making. We can pick the lock to this, but most of us don't. Locked within hyper-rationality. So the whole modernity, the individual, separate from nature, hyper-rational, very cognitive, very disembodied. And so there's an allergy that prevents us from having conversations relating to soul, to spirit, to the underworld, to all of this stuff. And I'm so down to talk this. I would like to. I'm so glad you brought this up. I feel that this is a conversation. It's a living conversation. The more of us, I would love for more of us to be having. I forget the original question nestled amidst that.
Well,
all.
It's interesting. I mean, I suppose that the thing that I'm enjoying being stuck on at the moment is how and why it is that soul work or soul craft is different from psychology or from going to therapy. That's what I want your brain on.
Sweet. So again, like you, full respect to psychologists and therapists, this is important work. There's a real distinction too. I'm just doing caveats here. There's a distinction between molting and dissolution. So just as a snake might molt its skin, we go through chapters in life where, you know, there is something you would have gone through that when you became a father. There's this kind of like, zoom, like you're like, all right, stepping up, new chapter here. There are different aspects that I need to step more into. Still authentic to you, but you're bringing more of that, and it's transformative in its own way. But what this soul work often speaks to is it links to, you know, a lot of work from Carl Jung. It speaks more to dissolution, which is where, from Bill Plotkin's sense, the adolescent self, the social identity that we craft for ourselves that helps us to get through society, of which the vast majority of people in the world are still in this adolescent phase. Some of us start to outgrow this adolescent self. And the pathway to what might be considered our more adult self involves a descent to soul. And soul, in Bill Plotkin's language, is the ecological niche in which we are contributing to the wider web, and we're in that individuated, unique role within the wider web of life. Now, this descent will feel irrational, and it will be counterthetical to a lot of the conventional therapy out there. Now, there's a distinction with depth psychologists versus other fields of psychology. Depth psychologists tend to have a sense of what's going on here. And there are definitely folks that have experience with soul work. but I would just... I think what it requires is, you know, and which is rare, is someone who understands the journey that folks are on, because the descent to soul, there's a lot of, I would, just to use the language, both Kim and I, we would consider ourselves to be in the cocoon at the moment. This sense of dissolution. You've met me. You met me in a dark space where, and you've helped, and I was just coming through after the wonderful plant medicine journey.
Yes.
But there's still a little more work for me to go in terms of coalescing here. Whereas most other folks would just be wanting to kind of get back on track, or, as you say, to fit back within the convention. So long story short, I've just kind of basically padded it out. I don't know if I've answered the question, but I'm resonating with your distinction.
But I'm glad you've gone there, and I like that language that you ended with there, because back on what track? And this is where we're going. Back on what track?
Whose track?
Whose goddamn track? Yes, mate. Whose track is this? You know, and I know, we often go there in our own way. You know, I like to talk about it as things like rigid personality construct, you know, these stories that you tell you about who you are. But it's deeper than that, because the stories that get force fed to you that let you decide who it is that you are, ego, inverted commas, that by design ricochets into some kind of trajectory, right, which is supposed to be your map, you know, or your front-footed linear momentum. Who's track man? You know, and that's what I worry about sometimes. There's a very real chance that it's not your track. And so that's where I get a bit sort of excited, but also torn up because are you riding the pendulum, or is it behind you and it's pushing you? Because that's not the same thing.
I just want to communicate somatically in a felt sense way. I feel so enlivened when you bring this up. So when I first started the podcast, I was mostly operating from residual insecurity and a sense of like, how are we being perceived, and talking in terms of market and so on. That happens sometimes where, you know, but like this stuff, this is what lights me up. As I know it does you too. Like, you know, we've got just even within reach here, this pertains to the Gurdjieff stuff.
You really wore me up to that guy, man. God damn it.
Mythology, all of these things, like a lot of the, you know, got the wild edge of sorrow here from Francis Weller. Like, this is, and I'm so glad you brought it up. So I feel that this world that we're in, with the algorithmic domestication, the relentless optimization towards homogenization, the fact that, and I've said this before, you know, it used to be that we could, I think I first heard this from Michael Dixon. I don't want to like pickpocket someone else's story, but the sense of it is, we used to be able to fly away to another country and disappear for a few months and then come back changed. But now, as soon as we land, we're back into the same social network. We're back in the same reinforcing feedback loops that hold us into a certain identity of who we are and who we ought be. And then we look at the algorithms or whatever it is, even if we have some discipline to avoid centralized social media, we're still going to be seeing it filtered in via the news and via the kind of late stage capitalist Western society sense of what success looks like and what the right and proper thing to do is. Mm-hmm. But if we attune, and poets, musicians, artists, philosophers, maybe not so much philosophers, but poets, musicians, and artists are very good at attuning to the heart's desires, to actually follow the muse, to follow whim, and you know, we've often reflected this. I feel as no mere happenstance that you and I became friends and that we met at the time that we did, because we've been
perfect
in
timing.
Yeah, it's so good. So, looping back to your question though, I find it very interesting. Bill Plotkin, his book, The Journey to Soul Initiation, which is his latest one, which is the one that Kim and I have been reading into, he actually wanted to call it The Descent to Soul. The publishers were like, no one wants to descend.
Don't
just
say
call
descend.
It a journey. But it seems to me that there's this almost unavoidable contending with grief and sorrow that is part of this journey, and we're very good at suppressing that and putting it off and distracting ourselves from that.
It was so unnerving, like thinking about what you said about that pickpocket from our friend Dixon. It's never really occurred to me properly that you don't get to disappear properly. Like, you don't, you know, there's that Radiohead song, I think it's called How to Disappear Completely, but we've lost how to do that. You know, I recall, you know, one of the fumes that I just wafted from Plotkin, one of his interventions is the power of getting lost. You know, I feel like you and I touched on this once, but how do you do that? Like, when's the last time that you got lost, Fizzle, properly lost?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like I've been lost in terms of, well, I feel like you know, late 2021 to late 2024 was a protracted period of me being lost, of not really having my bearings and not really having a clear grasp on who I am. But like in a physical sense, it's been a long time. I have a friend who's currently in Canada. He's going to be coming back to Australia. And he sent this text to me saying, hey, got this idea. When I'm back, he's got this old car that he's fixed up from like the 80s. He says, why don't we just go drive for 3 days, 2 nights, no phones, no maps, nothing. We'll carry cash, no cameras, and just see where we end up. And excellent. And just like, excellent. I love that idea. Like just no that's plan, great. No map. So hopefully
we'll get lost. It happened to me about a year ago. I was in Perth for work and I was stomping around Perth, and you know it better than I do, but my phone died. And it was awesome because my phone died. The sun was very down and I walked back to where I thought my hotel was, and I was wrong. I was like, this is not where I live, you know? So I got to enjoy this very real, it wouldn't have lasted more than 40 minutes, right? But this very real period where I started sort of simulating sleeping in the bushes, you know, and where's the bushes and how is it warm and what do I do? And it was just a fascinating, unnerving experience. And I'd realized then, this is the first time I've been lost in 15 years or something, but you can start to see, you know, stemming from what you were saying about bringing your social world with you in your pocket when you travel somewhere, you know, that's a very violent way to unplug, but it does force you to orient yourself in the world. And by doing that, you know, there's something so raw, unnerving and vulnerable about that, that you can see that it would move you to other breakthroughs. You know, it's surely going to nudge you into a stronger sense of identity. This is why, you know, even this morning I said to my wife in the car, I said, I think I need to go on a vision quest. You know, I'm going to crawl into the jungle and not eat for 4 days and just see what happens. Yeah. Caitlin hated it. You know, I could just tell she was very against the idea, and I didn't sell it to her properly. You know, I just kind of spurted it out without any kind of real build up. But there has to be something in that, doesn't there? There has to be something in that breaking yourself down in order to have that breakthrough.
You think about how rare it is for 4 consecutive days of no interruption, no technology, nothing but yourself, a tarp, a sleeping bag, and some water.
That's it. The element. The water.
It's on our, radar, Kim and I. Kim did her first solo overnight camp a few nights ago.
That's right. Kim had one night. She said it was one great night.
It was like a little sample of it. There were quite a few leeches, so that's the thing. I do feel though that these lovely books that are written about wilderness fasts and vision quests, they come from the Northern Hemisphere with their beautifully soft forests. And
that's such a good point, mate. Such a good point.
You know, in video games, when you're quite high level character and you unlock these new biomes. I think an Australian is a high level biome.
It's
like you, yes. Even if it's not for the snakes and the spiders, it's the fucking bull ants and like.
Jason, I can't last 4 minutes on my trampoline. I was on the trampoline yesterday, and we were getting mauled by mosquitoes. Absolutely rinsed.
Yeah.
I think you make a very good point. We have a far more violent wilderness. Absolutely.
Yeah. Certainly need to keep your wits about you. There is Animus Valley Institute that operate out of New South Wales running vision quests. There's also Nature's Apprentice here in Victoria that do things. It's effectively you have to find 11 days out of your calendar, and that's tricky. There's a few days camping, then you do the thing, and then there's a few days of integration afterwards. And you know, it's on the radar for us. And mostly, there's this. Oh, God. I mean, excited with you. Hey, you and I should do a camp anyway at some point.
Yeah, we should go camping. That'd be fun. That's so true. That's a really good goal for next year. I mean, because I heard a rumor that while Kim camped solo, a certain somebody had Oban to keep them company.
I shared it with a friend who had a van. He has this beautiful van camp set up, and we both played out Steam Decks into the evening. And But... No, they're open. They're such easy drinking. I sunk a fair bit. But you know what? I had Korean pear juice beforehand.
Oh, you did it. You did it.
And it was fine. I was fine. Wow. It was a miracle. Yeah. I know you said before and after. I only had the one, but even the one was magic.
Oh, you did the before. Yeah. And that's a tip that I got from my sister and any listener who hasn't heard it. You smash some Korean pear juice before a big night on the lash and you jump up, don't you? You jump up like a little groundhog the next day like nothing happened.
I want to chat with you briefly about this thing of you being lost and then scouting out places to sleep. Have you heard of, I think it's a Stoic thing. I think Tim Ferriss popularized this notion of fear setting instead of goal setting.
No, this sounds great. Let's talk about this.
It's basically where you kind of you think about what are your fears and then you live out your fears. Like, I'm worried that I'll be homeless and have to sleep on the streets. Well, cool. Go sleep on the streets. I'm worried that I'll like run out of food and stuff like that. Well, cool. Go on a fast or something. So I have this thing, Kim and I sometimes will point it out, but like where we're like looking at like, oh, that'd be a good place to sleep if need be, or, you know, but my big strategy is, I'm just going to waltz into conferences and have the sandwiches for lunch. That's my food sorted. You know what I mean?
Just walk in there and just blend in.
Look what you know what you're doing and stuff like that. And then I was chatting with the AV crew about this and they were vibing with it. But they said like the key is just make sure your shoes are okay because, you know, we have to naturally keep an eye out because it happens sometimes and stuff like that. And so they might be looking fine with, you know, but just, you know, make sure your shoes are okay.
Is the giveaway. So that's what we're going to keep in mind, that as part of living rough, you need boot polish, and a rag.
But I love this. I love, you know, your phone's died. I'm just imagining you stumbling out of a whiskey bar or something like that and like, shit.
How did you know?
And then it's like some sort of video game thing. You've got to find the hotel. That's your thing. But then your wits you'd be paying attention. Like, where was I? What's the angle? Yeah.
I'd sobered up real quick because I definitely I might have had a Vieux Carré and a couple of single malts, but I sobered up real quick when I was, you know, considering bush bashing my slumber. it was unnerving, but I guess that's the point that I'm making, is I also felt very alive, and it's a strange thing to get into around entertaining that deliberately getting lost might be in your interest. It might be in your interest to do, you know, because you're violently unplugging. You're unplugging and you're killing your device, and there's just, it's so insidious, the tech that we've come to lean on. I remember my guitarist saying to me, you know, he said, I don't know how to drive anywhere now because I've constantly got Google Maps on in my car. And then I read something just last week that I thought was really interesting. You know, there's rafts of research that suggest that people who suffer dementia and Alzheimer's in the early stages, they get very good at masking. Like they learn a whole bunch of really clever tricks into pretending that they're not losing any of their cognitive function. And apparently one of the early giveaways was that they would get lost. And that's how family and friends began to help nudge them towards a diagnosis. But now because of Google Maps, it's way easier to trick everyone into the idea that you're oriented when you're not.
So many parallels here. Like folks leaning heavy on AI, like thinking that they're quite smart and stuff. And then one day the servers go down or the prices goes up and be like, oh shit, I don't know how to do a bunch of
cognitive atrophy. We've arrived at cognitive atrophy. I mean, we're already there, aren't we? I mean, that's such a great term, cognitive atrophy. My God, it's already happening.
Yeah. I am genuinely trying to think about some creative constraints about, you know, particularly as we're both winding up towards the end of the year, as a bit of refresh. But I'm just thinking, how can I play 2026 a little differently? And I think I keep referring to this plant medicine journey, but ever since that, like I'm so much more porous to feeling, and so there I'm much more affected, and social media affects me, and I'm my responses are more emotional and embodied, and I feel like I need to be very disciplined about, you know, not slipping too deep into the algorithmic feed. I'm pretty good at maintaining discipline around it, but just every now and then I get tired, and then like, what the hell am I doing? Like,
And being intentional when you access and why you access and what you want from it. You know, I find that one of my safest approaches has always been not just uploading videos in the spirit of service, you know, might this be helpful? You know, not come to my seminar at the end. Just this video be helpful? And then the other one that I feel like I'm getting better at in the last couple of years is you log in as an audience member with love. So you just go into comment threads and go, "That was awesome. You're cool.
I like that. That's good.
You're the best. You know, keep it up. That's brilliant." I mean, why wouldn't you do that? You know, because if you really are, and this is sort of me talking to me here, but if I really am on there in the active service and I'm uploading videos in the active service, then along with that comes me just trying to support people, you know, and sometimes it's people that I don't know. Like I'll just sort of go in
that's lovely.
Say how awesome they are, or that they're a beacon or whatever. You know, where's the harm in that? And you can't, it's hard to log in and do that and then log out and say to yourself, "That was a waste of time," you know, because you were in there with a heartful agenda.
Yeah, I feel like your algos are dishing you up nicer things than mine these days. And it might be just I just need to just, you know, give, you know, fob it off for a while. We'll see. It's
you said it to me a couple of weeks ago, and I really enjoyed the comment. You said to me, "The algorithm is drunk," and it is drunk. I saw a lady today log in, ex-LinkedIn, and she said, "Hey, I used to work at LinkedIn," and just so everyone's clear, even the people at LinkedIn don't understand the algorithm. And then she went through to bust all of these myths about the way that it works. And it's almost like they're so obsessed with not being biased or not doing anything that feels overly commercial or sort of ad hungry that they themselves don't understand their own algorithm. You know, so even that I found I was pleased to hear it, to be fair.
So there's this. Yeah, I love that. There are some folks that I follow that have made, well, quite a few actually. I find that some of the most interesting things are from not the centralized platforms, and quite a few have like just left LinkedIn, left Instagram. I'm not sure if we can quite do that given the work that we do, and I think that partly our role is to oscillate into and out. But I've looked at those things and I'm like, "Oh, that'd be nice." Because certainly I want to be dedicating more time to reading physical books, which I already do quite a bit. But sorry, I'm just feeling a bit indulgent here, but I'm just, I get into this mode, you know, as we're getting close to the end of the year, of like I start reflecting and then thinking, okay, what do you have a sense? Oh, it's probably too early to ask you this, maybe next episode, but I'm just like, do you have a sense around... this is not a goal question, but like what you're seeking to invite more into your life, or what you're seeking to orientate more to, or you know, what, you know, thinking in terms of say the year ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lovely question. You know, it's funny because as you said it, it occurred to me that my answer is backwards. I've got a strong sense of what I don't want. Like I know the kind of things that I don't want to get mixed up in. You know,
that's
and I've
helpful
I've always...
though sometimes. It's, yeah, because it preserves emergence and novelty emerging, but
and
it's by a negativa.
Time.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and I think that's where I'm in. I want to protect my time. My deepest wish, as I've said to you before, is to suspend the beautiful gaze between my infant Luna, who's only 6 months old, and my beautiful wife. Like the longer I can keep those two, you know, in each other's, you know, within reach of each other's spirit. That's the overarching goal of next year. But I need to be very careful because along with that, I sometimes worry what might come from me is a scrappy kind of grubby approach to grabbing whatever gig gets near me because I'm preoccupied with that as an agenda. You know, and in the end, what it does, like I've thought it all the way through, it doesn't have a good knock-on because I become so exhausted, you know, within this grind that I've created for myself that then I feel like I'm giving my absolute best of me to transcend, which means that my family doesn't get the best of me. And this, I'm sure there's lots of listeners that can relate to this. You sometimes worry, am I giving all the best of me into the thing that's generating, you know, the income that supports my family, but then as a result, what version of my family, of me, Are they enduring? You know, and that's and so that's something that I'm trying to think a lot about next year. You know, sometimes I'll climb off an aeroplane. You know, this is only a couple of weeks ago, Fizzy, but I'm off the aeroplane and I'm bathing my daughter. And, you know, she's 6 months old, mate. Like, I can't even begin to articulate the joy of bathing your six-month-old baby girl. And I kept catching myself falling forward, almost headbutting the porcelain of the bath from exhaustion. You know, so I'm looking at myself and I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, I'm sort of torn between this look after them and look after them. Are you with me, legend?
Like, yeah,
look
man.
After them. Yeah. Versus looking after them. And so I just want to, next year, I want to get really good at striking that balance. Because if I can say to you that I'm very intentional about the projects that I get mixed up in, I don't backflip and let people try to bargain me. Like, you don't get to tell me, you don't get to say how much I cost. I know my value. I want to get better at that, legend, because then I would feel like I'd be protecting my time and being the best version of me, you know, in and outside of Transcend.
Yeah. With you. It's an interesting thing, isn't it, too, that, you know, our life, you know, we'll be on stage, we'll be the rock star and stuff like that, and people applauding and lining up to chat with you and so on, get back home, putting out the rubbish and so on, kind of exhausted and so on. You have these beautiful moments with your daughters and so on. And I think sometimes it's like, I think to myself and Kim, where, you know, part of the joy of being in a deep committed relationship is you can just be unmasked. You can be your complete you know, rubbish self. And they can too, and that's like completely loved and accepted. But it does make me think sometimes where I'm like, shit, you know, like the amount of presence, the conviviality, the joy, the spontaneity, the energy, the magic, the wonder is so much higher when I'm working with like clients and stuff like that than, you know,
that's right.
It's easy to forget to bring some of that at home, and also to respect that home is for restoration and solace and renewal and so on. But yeah, I'm with you. There's a...
Yeah, it's balance, isn't there? And, you know, this is something that just occurred to me. You know, when I'm teaching people in middle management, one of the things that I love banging on about is how to be a great leader. One of the most integral skill sets is to behave like a circuit breaker or a filter between all the pressure above you and what it is that you choose to cascade down onto your team, right? And that one that one always hits hard and resonates, because people realize very quickly, oh, sometimes when I'm stressed, I take all that stress and I vomit it down onto my team, you know, equals I'm a shit leader. And so it's always a really nice sort of early mindset shift that I love to get going. And, you know, and being a conscious filter and deciding, well, what is it that you let trickle through from the pressures that you're feeling onto the people that you're supposed to be motivating, inspiring, empowering, and supporting? But then I sometimes worry that as a sole trader, you know, I don't have any colleagues, right? So I sometimes think, am I just oversharing the nuance of every goddamn thing that happens to me with my wife? Like, does Katie really need to hear all of this? You know, I just got this email and this is what they said and here's how I wrote back. Like, it's sometimes I think, do I really need to put her across the detail of what I mixed up in here? I'm not being a circuit breaker. You know, I'm not behaving like a circuit breaker between some of the stuff that I get to sift through and what I cascade, you know, onto my missus.
There's something you said there, because we don't have any colleagues. One of the things that I am looking to bring into this world, because I've had the great fortune of being part of such a thing, is I'm so not used to sharing stuff that's still in draft, but I effectively want to start the equivalent of a thieves guild, but for freelance, independent consultants and practitioners. And by thieves guild, I'm just talking about a group where, you know, you have a bunch of different kind of specialist generalists or generalist specialists. Like, everyone individually can do most things. They're highly omnicompetent. Yeah. But, you know, in a thieves guild, you have the lock picker, you have a cat burglar, you have the swindler, you have, like, everyone has their different skills, but we're all kind of united, right?
Yeah.
And then the whole thing is like, yeah, cool, we're all independent consultants, but sometimes we'll band together to work on some big projects. And sometimes we'll refer each other work. And, you know, the guild might get like a small cut that then gets used for marketing and so on. And nice. I like that. I've been this before. The camaraderie is so good. And when you get these weird emails, you've got a bunch of colleagues that could be like, that'll heal you. You've got the guild. And see, what's happened is I've had that in the past, but then a lot of the friends that I used to do this stuff with have then gone and created their own consulting firms. And when they do that, they become a bit of a like a black hole or a vortex for all opportunities, because they've got to keep their revenue up, which means that they'll give the opportunities to their junior folks and so on. And just and that spirit of, you know, like us as individuals, there's only so much work that you and I can do, and then, you know, we're cooked for the year. Like, so that's like handle. You just and then sometimes it's so fun working with kindred spirits, and then the client gets the synergy of like, you know, two or three or four really talented minds working together that is so much more potent than a, you know, a big consulting firm just churning out their templated, you know, cookie cutter.
And so much more nimble and agile and quick and bespoke, tailored, customized, you know, purpose fit.
So
I love that, man.
Something like that might emerge for us. Yeah.
That's fantastic, mate. Yeah. That's really exciting. This, you know, if anything, I hope this rouses you to continue to share ideas that are in draft, because that's very tantalizing, man. Who wouldn't want to be in that thieves guild?
After working 9 years on a book and not sharing it with this, and then seeing someone I admire like share an essay of the same title, I'm going to try to share some of these things in motion. Hey, quick question. Should we do a little thing for a fake ad, or should we like skip this one?
Yes. Yep, let's drop it in there. I have an idea in my head for it. I haven't recorded it yet, but I've got something. So thank you, Fizzy. Here comes the fake ad. It might not even be an ad, but it's something.
Do you struggle to show an interest in anything? Has it occurred to you that not giving a shit could be in some way career limiting? Do you understand the idea that curiosity comes across like hypocrisy inside the meaning of your own buckled velocity? Well, here's a turn of phrase to keep you edgy and interesting by being interested. Do you mind if we just double-click on that? sorry, Barry, I'd like to go back. Can we just double-click on what you just said there? look, that's interesting, but if we could just quickly double-click on that. Listen, I like it. I think I'm into it. It's got my attention, but first, can we just quickly double-click on that? Double-click on that. Yeah.
I mean, I know that it's a primarily audio medium, but I just wish that listeners could see how close my Roland SPDX drum pad is, so they could appreciate how useless I am in missing contact with it. Well, what's the strike rate, Fizz? Like, I reckon I mishit it probably two out of three hits.
Oh, my God. No, I'd say you mishit just over half the time, yeah. Yeah,
it's less than 40 centimeters away from me, and I can't make contact with it. Good. No, anyway, let's hope that everyone enjoyed that big ad.
Dude, I reckon let's segue to whiskey. But before I do, I just want to say, like, I just love chatting with you and the way your mind works and the things that are emergent for you. And it just, you know, I say to Kim sometimes, like, I get this, what do you call it, like a vulnerability hangover or an authenticity hangover, which I love. Like, it's a sign of a good conversation. It's and one of the things, you know, it's some of the this person I was chatting with in the Netherlands last night, they were just saying, like, just how much they love hearing us and just what we're grappling with, because it makes it seem so real. And in their words, they were just saying about how, you know, so much, and this is me paraphrasing, but, you know, so many folks put forward, this kind of professional, got it all figured out, squeaky clean, or a kind of manufactured authenticity, which, you know, has a just and the right amount of vulnerability and so on. But yeah, I don't know. We got something special going on here.
I appreciate you, my friend. And, you know, it is lovely because sometimes I can admit, you know, I'll log in and I might have had a weird morning or got disrupted by something or, you know, had a miscommunication with a client or, you know, it's sort of often it's a simulated idea of what I thought was coming and then not being married up. You know, it's exactly what I got into earlier when I was talking about Albert Ellis and trying to delete what should and must and ought to or better be. But, you know, one thing that I love so much when I speak to you is that quite often before I know what's going on, I find myself right on the edge of my chair, you know, with a really sort of upright and energized posture. And I realized that I find the conversations very enlivening, man. So, you know, it's definitely it's a symbiotic simpatico, my good man.
I've been working on my /about page, which I hadn't updated for like years. And it's torture. It is so hard. It's so hard but it's fun as well. Like, it's good suffering. But there's this word, I didn't end up dropping it in, but I really love that word you use, enlivening. Like, there is something about when we are enlivened. I think about the same thing. You've walked out of the, you know, whiskey bar, it's nighttime, your phone's died, you've got to get back to your hotel. Bam, just how like enlivened you become, like you're paying attention, you're tuned, you're like, you're sensing your way. And like, I feel like the, you know, we bang on about all the time, all this efficiency, all this kind of algorithmic ease dulls and kind of deadens and dims that sense of enlivened acuity and attunement.
And it's getting worse. You know, let's not go there because we're about to drink whiskey, but I do want to echo that. I'm trying not to swear too much. I want to emphasize that sickening thing that you and I extracted from that face melting podcast. What's it called again, Fizzy? The great simplification.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
So the idea that we now understand that social media was stealing our attention, whereas AI is stealing our attachment. And if you just think about that properly for a second, you know, and stay on your idea about us numbing, I mean, if you think we're numb now, just strap in for the next 7 years and watch what happens as we, the guinea pigs, get to endure the tsunami that is having attachment mind.
Yeah.
Anyway, should we drink some whiskey?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Let's do it. And now,
I know that was bad timing to do that.
Oh, but no. This is great. I think this is just so topical. Like, again, like thinking back to the start of this episode, like I was going to like try to argue the other point and stuff like that. It was bringing some structure in. Part of what makes this work is the aliveness. We're attuned. We don't know what's happening next. We're paying attention. We're enlivened to this moment right now. You know, as you say that, and Dr. Zachary Stein is, you know, he's brilliant mind, so well articulated. We've seen just how devastating social media has hijacked our attention. Now we're witnessing artificial intelligence hijack attachment. As a parent, I can imagine that it's like horrifying to think that, you know.
Harrowing.
And then I shared you that link, right, with a startup about, you know, cool, record your grandma or whatever, and then she can go on and, you know, your kids can have conversations and your grandkids can have conversations with your grandma. Sounds good in theory, but it's just going to trap people in these recursive loops that is a facsimile, a simulacrum, a kind of a false, shallow imprint of the vast, complex being that your grandparents are. Why would you want to? Why? I just... It's
harrowing. It's a zombie echo, you know, that would get progressively further away from the essence of who that person was.
But, and to segue to whiskey, I do feel I'm witnessing, and you're probably seeing this too, there is a countercurrent. There are folks that are beginning to say, wait a minute, nah, fuck this. We don't, like, enough's enough. And they're starting to kind of reclaim a sense of sovereignty, a sense of presence, a sense of community, a sense of, like, slowness and reverence and so on. And I'm heartened by this
it has to. There has to be a split. And that's why you and I talk about the Renaissance rewound. You know, I just hope that as we arrive at this fork, that it doesn't amplify any kind of division. Like it doesn't need to be the way forward. And that's why it's grim, but there's still that huge instinct in me that thinks we're heading towards the breakthrough before the breakdown. I mean, I'd like to talk to you about this Yan Li Kun guy who's walking away from Meta and where his head's at now about the idea that the future of AI is not large language models. He reckons that stuff's going to be dead in 3 years. But then as he talks about the way that he thinks the real AI should be learning, it's terrifying, man. It's so unnerving. Yeah. Look at us. We're doing it. We're avoiding the whiskey and talking about AI.
I just want to add one more link in, though. This links back to the Bill Plotkin and the Soul work. The world is going to need adults, and that means it's going to need folks who have evolved beyond their socialized selves that have been groomed to fit within the system and are living into their actualized, individuated soul work, which means showing up in a role that is contributive to what I would say is a world more curious and kind. Like, we need to have folks that are willing to go through that path, the descent and so on, so that we can show up as our fuller, more individuated selves to help the world around us.
I love it, mate. And what a beautiful idea to hold on to. You know, how is it that you can position yourself as a beacon that encourages people to live into the poem that they are born to be?
Yes.
Shall we crack it now? The color of this one is fascinating. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. How old do you think that would be?
Okay, so just at the glance, I would say it's under 15 years, so I'm just going to say it's 11 years old.
All right. Well, I actually forget how old, but it's going to be on the bottle. But let me a build-up. Let me just show you the box, right?
Yeah, please.
This box is cool. Check out this dude.
So, is that a magician on there?
It's a magician. It's got a little devil having a bit of a perv. You got a
pervy devil
chick hanging like a scantily
clad siren.
She's a siren. There's a bit of a moon there.
Chicky I thought she was moon. Holding a sickle, but that's the tip Same. Of the
that's,
moon.
That's the tip of the moon. There's some bats. Oh no, that's an owl down the bottom.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, this guy's got it going on.
That's a vintage box. That moon reminds me of the Mac the Knife mascot from a McDonald's commercial from a few years ago. Beautiful.
What a box. Yeah, so...
It looks like sort of 20s circus artwork, doesn't it?
And here is the bottle itself. It's an independent bottling. You can see there is this wizard dude here. He's sitting down in front of a grimoire looking pretty perturbed because I think he's just accidentally summoned this... sexy devil.
Oh, he summoned a demon.
Yeah. And
this Beelzebub by accident.
This is a 14-year-old whiskey, would you believe?
Well, that's great because I said under 15, so I got it.
Oh, okay, well done. Yeah. It to my mind it looks like an 11 or a 12. This is part of the Masters of Magic High Spirits independent bottling of the Islay single malt from Cal Illa Distillery. It was distilled in January 2008, bottled in March 2022.
Wow.
So, Cal Illa is from Islay. You're going to have to brace yourself. It's going to be maritime. Peat. Yeah,
I could tell from the color it's going to be peat, but I'm going to stop talking to here. Now, remember, it has become the twist plop. No, twist pop. Plop. The twist pop. Plop.
Twist and pop and slush.
Twist pop and slush. It's almost impossible. Good luck.
Okay. Thank you. It's. I'm feeling it. Okay. Twist, pop, and slush. Okay. Here we go. Oh, fuck it. It was just merely pop.
And even better. Sans twist was you kind of cursing, like fucking. It was you wrestling.
There's no twist on this. Look, I can twist this. Look at this.
There's no twist. It's completely twistless.
There we go. Okay. Listeners, please forgive me. I'm going to do round two. Okay, ready?
There it is, sir. There it is. That was outstanding.
I learned from the best.
Yeah. That was a haunted house doorknob creak. Like, you really lent into that twist.
Yes, thank you, thank you. I mean, yeah. This is... We should do a masterclass one day and have, like, a whole hour dedicated to help people, like, master the twist and pop and slush. all right, great.
Get slushing.
Right. Now for the pour.
Oof. Hey, that was cool. Like, I'm sure it wasn't on purpose, but you rim bashed it, and so we got glass... We got a ting to a ting ting.
Bit of a rim job there, yeah.
couldn't help yourself. All right, here's my slosh. Here's my sloshy.
That was good.
Could you hear the bottle doing that?
I did. Yes.
Outstanding.
Fucking hell. Oh, that's great. Have you been practicing?
There's the thing, we can't practice because these are the samples that you've handed me, so I keep them sealed in there.
Oh, but you can like refill one with water and just like get it.
You know, do your
like
reps.
A proper montage. Like, yeah, that's right.
Do your plop reps, baby.
All right.
Yes, I'm nosing it straight away, Fizzy. See, you've already primed me when you said maritime, but that's what's awesome about this is straight away, like, I'm getting like a rickety jetty and seagulls, mm-hmm. and I'm getting like the clanky, rusty chain of some derelict wharf gadget shit that no longer does anything.
Yeah. There's a, I love the, so I grew up in a coastal town and there's something about, when the waves are rough and you get like this, they're almost like so rough that the sea is there's like a foamy saltiness to it.
Yes.
And when that kind of foamy wave, whatever it is on the basaltic rocks or something like that, there is a particular aroma and it's not just the iodine of salt spray, but something about like salt foam on rocks. And that's kind of something
right.
I get on this.
I like you got the rocks there. I'm getting I'm getting something botanical as well. Like, I keep picturing all the grass up in the sand dunes.
Mm. Yeah. I don't know if this is just me, but there's a particular quality to the smell of hundreds and thousands. A sweetness, like a slightly medicinal sweetness, or like, I don't know if you ever had to have medicine that was like sweetened to kind of make it go down better.
Yeah,
but like,
you know what? Yes. It's funny as you said that because I was, and this is very specific, but I was picturing if you suck hundreds and thousands, really they're just all white. You know, that fizzy, like all the food coloring disappears and they're white there. But then I guess what we're both agreeing on in our own way is sort of it's an artificial sweetener. Like, it doesn't smell like pure sugar cane. It smells like an artificial sweetener.
Yeah. Yeah. You say artificial?
Yeah. I think I said artificial. It was official. I'm trying to make this official.
Artificial. Artificial.
I'm trying to get this fresh out of the kitchens.
And
right,
I get
you know what I like
of,
about it?
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I just also get a sense of commercial white bread.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. I like that you've gone there. I'm not getting violent peat, which I'm excited about. Like, it's clearly not an octomore. It's not going to smash me. I don't expect it to be overpowering. There's a grassy botanical coming through with all that oceanic stuff. I'm just going to attempt to put a tiny bit into the spit chalice. I know you so well now, legend, that as you kind of like sheepishly glanced around, you've lost your spit chalice.
I just need a reminder next time we catch up beforehand.
Okay.
Yeah, I just need to dedicate some time to find it. Like, I've put it, I do this thing where I put it somewhere special, somewhere safe.
And then you forget the special. I'm just spit chalicing now. Well, I'm excited about this one, man. I'm ready. Are you ready? Oh, sorry, you're still spit chalicing.
Okay, I'm ready now.
Let's go. Whew. Wow, you know the first thing that came to me? Marmite. Not Vegemite, Marmite, which is a bit more aggro than Vegemite, if you ask me.
Oh, the power of like word suggestion, because now, yes, of course, my mouth is flooded with Marmite, which is not an experience that I would court. It's what is it? It's 55%, I should have said.
Oh, you little danger mouse. I'm really happy to share with you that we're hanging our Christmas tree tonight. So Dad's going to have a bit of a pep in his step.
Yeah, Christmas tree might be a bit wonk.
Wonk tree. That's in my chest, Fizzy. It's a lovely winter warmer, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Just couldn't have snuck it in like one of the last weeks of spring. There's a brininess to this. I definitely, you know, the water that they're sampling here has some salt in it.
I want to say oysters. I don't eat a lot of oysters, but I'm getting it because there's a meaty quality along with that salt.
Yeah, and I know this is not necessarily your preferred flavor profile, but I find I just really like the independent bottling and obviously the artwork here. But it's also I would consider this as an interesting second whiskey to have if you're planning to have like three. And it does suit for like a more kind of colder climate situation.
It's really warming the cockles. Like, you know, and again, like we're talking about the power of suggestion, but as soon as you said it was 55 ABV, my eyes both burst with water and I felt a real, I kind of had that ET heart glow. Like I had that warming in my chest. I'm struggling to describe the finish on this one. And I think it might be, as you say, because of my inexperience with peats. What are you getting on the legs of this bad boy?
It's like there is a faint, the peat is very light and the peat is not so much peat smoke, but imagine it feels like a lot of green leaves that have been crushed up and there's been an attempt to create a fire, but it hasn't worked. And you've got like slightly singed, but ultimately too wet, like green leaves and stuff like that.
Yeah, I love that.
But obviously like what type of leaves? Are we talking eucalyptus leaves? You know, so I feel like there is something like the leaves of trees that would grow in coastal heathlands. So like
because I'm taking that, like I could easily pluck that grass that's up in the sand dunes, you know, that helps with erosion. And someone's plucked that fresh and tried to light a fire with it and it's not dry enough. And so you're getting that kind of that botanical burnt green smell with that sort of with the charcoal-y flame, but not, it's not a peat monster.
No, it's a kind of, I don't know, there, I feel like there's a white sugar sweetness that goes through this. There is a bit of carry in that regard.
I find it useful. I find it useful when you reintroduce the sweetness, because if I, and this is just my mind, but if I start going too hard towards oyster, then I start thinking about the oyster shell and whatever the dried inside of an oyster shell tastes like, if you were to tongue dash it. And then I started thinking about, you know, it's amazing, isn't it? The connotations, like that's why I love hearing from people like Lachlan from Scotch Malt Whiskey Society, like the romance in the way that someone that talented describes whiskey, you bring people with you on it. You know, it's amazing how you can influence someone else's palate with the power of words.
So I thought to do a post on this, and I just remember just now that I've actually written down tasting notes for when I first had this. Would you like to hear what I wrote?
Yes.
In a different experience? So yeah, on the please. Nose, fish and chip shop potato cake, balsa wood, caster sugar, rock pools, and white ash.
Rock pools. See, that's me tongue bashing the inside of an oyster shell.
Yeah.
Rock pools. What was the last thing?
White ash. There was this sense of, and it's not quite astringent, but like the way on the nose, it would just kind of, there's not quite a linger, it would just,
You just put in my head the idea of a potato scallop. So, you know, when you spoke about the fish shop, what did you say about it? Did you say potato cake?
Fish and chip shop potato cake, yeah.
Is that like a scallop fizz?
Yeah, it's a like a deep fried slice of potato that's battered. And
yeah, great. I don't know. I wonder if that's a Perth thing, like, because we just call it a potato scallop, but you said cake? I've never heard it put that way.
Yeah, it's Australia's odd like that. So I think they call it potato cake in Melbourne too, but it would vary. Yeah.
Because I appreciate the word scallop is confusing because then there's the actual fish scallop. So it's
yeah,
weird.
Yeah.
But you know what you did there? That was useful to me because you gave me the oil. You know, it's funny because I don't eat fish. I wish I did, but I didn't get fed it as a kid. And as I try to eat seafood as an adult, it just reminds me of getting dumped at the beach, right? And so I can't really eat much seafood. But you know, you can always tell if you're eating chips from a fish and chip shop because the chips have been cooked in the same oil as the fish. And they take on that kind of subtle oceanic flavor. And so I think that's really clever for you to say potato cake slash scallop because that's what's going on. It's not a punch in the face, but there's that nuanced hint of, this has been in contact with the sea. It's not the sea.
So that was the nose. But the palates, it's funny. Mm. You mentioned oyster shells. I also mentioned oysters with a squeeze of lemon. Olive oil, hundreds and thousands in white bread, and burnt sugar.
Fantastic.
But yeah, and then the finish, I wrote lit newspaper, warm granite, and jetty wood. So
this
yeah.
gave me the best memory. When I was a kid, my dad used to light a barbecue in our backyard with scrunched up newspaper. And I'm pretty sure that's the way that he got it going. Like, I don't think we cooked our whole meal on burning newspaper, but I think it was... You know, his equivalent of a fire starter.
Yeah.
And he put this really cute idea in our head as kids because we love to help. You know, we're there scrunching up the paper. It's exciting. We're helping Dad build a fire. But he put this really cute idea in our head that it wouldn't be a good idea to burn red ink. And so we would sort of like feverishly, you know, scramble through the newspaper and then outlaw any print that was in red because we didn't want to burn that because we might poison ourselves. Like, it's just such a cute
That's
thing
great.
To think about.
That's awesome. Because, yeah.
Isn't that funny? Because as an adult, it's clearly a nonsense. You know, if you're burning ink, you're burning ink. But I can remember the novelty of getting mixed up in that. Mm. And the most charming thing about the memory of that is that, you know, my dad in his own way helped to create the illusion that we were being helpful. You know, that's great.
The essence
of the, you know, Dad, this is red. You know, you'd snatch it out of his hand. Dad, that's a red one. And he'll go, thanks, son. You know, I'm glad you caught me on that. Isn't that beautiful? Like, that's a great thing to think about.
You're going to be able to do stuff like that with Phineas and Luna too. Yeah.
I love doing it, man. Like, you know, one of my favorite memories as a kid, because my little brother is 6 years younger than me and he's my best mate. And when he was a kid, I was teaching him how to be a ninja. Now, just so we're clear, I have no idea how to be a ninja, right? But I was teaching him how to do it. And I remember telling him that if you want to creep up on someone for like an attack, that you can't step on any leaves. Like, don't step on any leaves because that crinkle, that's going to, you know, give your position away. And one of my favorite moments, this is one of my favorite all-time Big Brother moments, was a couple of weeks later, my sister Louise was trying to tease him. She's like, "You're not a ninja, Joshua. You don't know how to be a ninja, you little loser," like typical sibling banter. And my brother said, "Yeah, I bet you don't even know anything about being a ninja, like how you're not allowed to step on the leaves, right?" And it was just so nice. It was just so nice hearing him, like, you know, he was spouting the ninja gospel back to my sister. It was a beautiful moment for me. It was like, wow, you know, as a big brother, you know, especially That's when cool. they're that young, they're really listening to you, man. They're really absorbing whatever garbage you're coming up with. It was nice.
You gave me such a memory of, like... You know when you have like a drink coaster and you throw it like a shuriken?
Yeah.
Like how fun that is. And also how fucking dangerous it can be. Like it can really, like do some serious damage. Yeah.
You can take an eyeball, sir.
Yeah,
You can take an eyeball. Oh, man, thank you so much. That was great. And listen, one thing I love that you and I are doing is we're pushing each other outside of our whiskey comfort zones.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was absolutely thrilled at the Whiskey Abbey event for you and I to come across. Man, can we just talk about it? That Glendronach. Mm. It was a Glendronach 12 from the 80s. I mean, we should put the bottle on Substack so people can see it.
For sure.
We should do that, Fizz. Let's put the bottle on Subby.
Mm.
But It had been sent to Japan and then somehow found its way back into Melbourne, and they opened it for that event. And so we drank a 12-year-old Glendronach from the 80s, and it was the unicorn of the day, man. Like, God, that was a good whiskey. And the point I'm trying to make is I've pushed you into sherry bomb territory, and I like that you're nudging me into peat town. It's really good, really useful.
Yeah, we're going to dance with some lightly peated ones. But yeah, I'm loving the sherry whiskeys. I'm keeping an eye on some Glendronachs.
When are we going to go? So good. When are we going to Speyside, man? We have to go to Speyside.
It would be nice to do a bit of a tour, wouldn't it?
We have to go to Speyside, or just Scotland in general, but Speyside is not so much an if, but a when for us. Like, we got to go to Speyside.
It's a nice thing to think that, you know, once the kids are old enough and everything's, you know, smooth and stuff like that, we could do some sort of like road trip or, you know, something.
Create some excuse to get there. Now, Legend, let's launch into some bad advice, because I've just realized that I'm going to snatch my beautiful kid from school at some point this afternoon.
Yeah, let's do it.
I'm trying to think back where we started. That's right. We're talking about making a theory. It is. Make sure you, as soon as you can, even if you're not sure about something, make it a thing. Okay? Turn it into a thing. Decide what it is. Lock it down. Set it in stone. Gaze into it haphazardly and Medusa what it was. Turn it into stone with such violent rigidity that it never moves, rendering it anti-nebulous.
If you're feeling a bit insecure about how you might not have properly represented all perspectives, force yourself to take the position that it doesn't come naturally to you for the sake of balance. people love it.
It's too good. Use AI. No, I can't pretend. This is the thing. Like, you can't dabble with the false oracle and then just be completely anti. And you and I are yet to get even close into an actual AI conversation on this podcast. And I kind of feel like that's deliberate, and one day we're going to go there. But use AI for everything and allow it to second guess who it is that you are and what it is that you want for yourself, and use it not only for anything that you're about to attempt to author yourself, but also use it for your responses. So before you decide how you want to respond to anything that comes at you, run that past the false oracle too, until you arrive at a place where your voice and its voice is so intertwined that you've lost all sense of who it is that you used to be. And there you are, Sarah Connor.
nice. Well, hey, if you feel called to something beyond yourself, if you feel a sense of vocation, if you feel a sense of deeper meaning and stirring that is, that feels like you are being drawn into your own becoming, best get some conventional therapy.
I was hoping you'd do this one.
That sounds very unproductive. Like, that sounds like, you know, that's not going to make you money, is it? That's not going to make you money. So come on.
This is great. You know, do you ever get the sense that everyone around you has drunk the Kool-Aid? You know, are your instincts telling you that everything about the system that you're inside of is twisted and wrong and corrupt and broken? Go to therapy, and that way you'll be able to recalibrate yourself to the shitful reality that you are forced to endure. No, don't try to be involved in changing it. Don't mess with it. Don't push back on it. Don't disrupt the parameters. Nay, don't become a beacon that's involved in trying to change the conditions, not only for yourself, but for the people that you care about. just find a way to brainwash yourself into a place of muted acceptance.
It's so good, because I was reading that there's this person I follow, I love her work, and she comments on AI very well, but she's like, she said in this one piece, to be clear, this is someone based in the US, very close to Silicon Valley, and she was saying, you know, she said, If I overthink, if I think about things too much, even I become a bit of a doomer. But blah, 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 blah. And it's kind of like the whole thing of like, just don't think about it too much. Just don't think about it too much. It's all good. I mean, carry on.
I mean, but that's, and that's a whole other fun conversation, because that's a whole other exciting conversation. And maybe now flip it back into, you know, the not
good
bad
advice. Yeah. Part of it. Good to demarcate that. are we still doing bad
advice? Hang on. I often think how funny is, like, if you're a first time listener coming in at episode 10, you're like, why are these guys saying all this twisted shit right at the end? Like you don't explain the format of the podcast. People don't understand that you're deliberately giving bad advice. But true. Legend. This thing about the doomer, like, that has my attention too, because in the same way that you and I agree that you shouldn't fully look into the face of something and that you want to kind of glaze it, you know, with your peripheral and then back into trying to live in the penumbra and all that other, you know, beautiful language that we have, there is that part of me that knows for certain that if you really want to properly graduate down to the violent, dark frequency that is the way that a lot of things are now, then you are a doomer. Like, you've absolutely done it to yourself. You know, there has to be some kind of balance that lets you ride the pendulum into how bad things are, but then ride it back out into the potentiality of how it is that you hope that they could be. It's easy to be a Bowser, isn't it, man? Like, it's so easy to be a doomer. And I just think that's an important place to linger, isn't it? Because I'm not talking about, you know, ignorance is bliss or denying how grim the world is. But you can ride the pendulum into the darkness and then hold on to it and ride it back out again.
Yeah, you know, it's easy to be a doomer if we're paying attention. There's a line from Dougal Hine and Paul Kingsnorth in the Dark Mountain Project. It's the end of the world as we know it, but it's not the end of the world, full stop. And there are post-tragic, post-doom sensibilities where the thing is where we might come to an acceptance that shits and the momentum that we've got is going to take us on a particular trajectory, and it is too late to course correct in some senses, but doesn't mean we switch off and give up, because there's so much to do yet still. So there's a kind of a pragmatism, a realism and an idealism that's kind of both and all at once.
It's the dance, isn't it? And, you know, it sort of ties nicely into it, because, you know, the end of the world as you know it might also for you represent the end of the world of the way that you wish that it would be, or the way that, like, it was better when it was.
Yeah, like how,
you know, now you're attached to nostalgia. What were you going to say, brother?
Well, just like how Nate Higgins has the great simplification. He's like, in many ways, it will be great. You know, so whilst we're having to put up with much less energy, it means that we're going to be spending more time in community. We're going to be in our bodies. We're going to be like, in some senses, it will be a great simplification, not just in terms of size and impact, but it'll also be great. I think it's disposition, right? It's the trick to fresh from the kitchen with the trick to disposition. Yeah,
it is, man. And I guess that's something fun that we like to marinate in. You know, it's one part recalibration. You know, these are the new conditions, but it's also not such a recalibration that you mute yourself into a place of reluctant acceptance. You know, you're allowed to rattle some chains, and you're allowed to sort of point to and be involved in future best states. You don't have to be a twig in the stream. You are also the stream.
There's this concept of weird or word. Where I think it's a Nordic thing where you've got the three sisters that are writing everyone's fates, and it's pretty much as is written. But the thing about the word is that it can be tweaked, and you can find these moments where if you're attuned and you have this sense of the kairos, if we switch to Greek, you can jilt and kind of tilt what was otherwise a kind of predetermined path. But it's like, no, we've just evoke something. So it's kind of like a both end to fate, but also the agency to influence.
That's it. I love that. And it's the agency, you know, if you are the rock being skimmed across the pond, you know, what are you able to gently influence the angle so that you petit jeté instead of face
palm? You know? I love it when you weave in these languages, petit jeté.
Can you petit? But maybe I'll choose to petit jeté instead of face plant, and that choice was a 1 degree shift in the trajectory of the way that the rock was hitting the surface, you know, of the pond in that moment.
Exactly.
Great. Well, that's lovely. Well, Fizz, it's been a genuine pleasure as always, man. Thanks for lifting me out of my weirdness.
Likewise. You know, thanks for delicately. Oh, and me too. Thanks for kind of like,
gentle nudge away from that and into this.
Hang on. Dude, are you bringing an agenda to this conversation yet again?
And also, I just couldn't keep up with it. I was like, I'm not sure what he's trying to do, but
I just had to expunge. I had a little ball of insecurity. So thanks for that.
I'm left with no choice but to course correct.
That's great.
Oh, all legend. Right. Always a
Should
pleasure,
we do the
man.
Bang?
And what a pleasure to say that was episode 10 of Kindred Spirits. A massive shout out to all of our beautiful, warm listeners. Thank you again for your pulse, your energy, your spirit, your feedback, your support. You know, we're here as a collective and we're thrilled to have you with us.
Yes, hear, hear. Thanks, everyone.
Presto.